So this is an interview that I recorded with Rick Baruda, who is the Public Programs Manager of the C.G. Young Institute in San Francisco, and we had this conversation back in December of 2019. Hope you enjoy the show.
It's the Scarcity Complex Podcast!
All right. Well, hey, everybody. This is Jay, and you're listening to the Scarcity Complex Podcast, and today, as you know, I like to talk to interesting people, and one of those people that we're talking with today is my friend Rick. And if you want to find out more about Rick, you can go to the website. I'll have a little blurb about him there. But Rick and I have known each other for, how long have we known each other now? I'm trying to think.
Gosh, maybe 5 or 6 years.
I think five or six years. And we met up at...
at the Esalen Institute in Big Sur, California.
How would you describe Esalen if somebody's never heard of the Esalen Institute?
Esalen is this magical place on the Pacific Coast in California that it just is isolated enough from most people's everyday world, and where you drop in and you're meeting all kinds of new people from all kinds of places. Mostly there for the same reason, to discover something about themselves that they can't find or access in the everyday world.
And you went there from, I think you were coming off of New York, right? That's what we were talking about earlier. Is that right?
I had spent the summer in New York. I had walked the Camino de Santiago de Compostela that spring. And so all that led me to Esalen.
And so speaking of the Camino, that's something that, again, I think a lot of people may or may not have heard about. Do some people call it, they just call it the Camino, right? Is that right?
Yes, but there are also many Caminos, quote unquote, around the world. So okay, to be culturally appropriate, I wanted to specifically identify the Compostela. For sure.
Gotcha. And this is the, quote, famous one that most people talk about. Is that right or not?
Paulo Coelho has written about it. Shirley MacLaine has written about it. It's probably one of the most known. Yeah.
Okay. And explain for people that may or may not know what that particular Camino is, maybe just talk a little bit about that in terms of what that is and even, yeah.
It has pre-Christian origins. And some say that it lies along a ley line along the earth, an energy path that intersects the earth's surface that humans have supposedly been able to tune into for millennia. but most people know it as a 500-mile walk from the Pyrenees in France to the town of Santiago in Spain. And... where you backpack traditionally, walk on foot, carry all your belongings, and not know where you're going to eat or where you're going to stay from night to night. And again, it's a seeker's experience. It's a time to reflect and step outside of your everyday world. Historically, in Catholicism, it was a rallying point for pilgrims and overthrowing the Moors, getting them out of Spain. And since then, it has been a religious pilgrimage for many, many Christians around the world.
And it's really tends to transcend even people that are just Catholic, right? Or just...
absolutely.
Like it's kind of become a more of a, almost a mystical kind of experience and journey for...
regardless of whether you're on vacation with your family for 2 weeks or you're going to bike it across the country in 8 days along the Camino, or you're in some type of a life transition and you're taking this time to really go deep within, there's no wrong way to have a spiritual experience on the Camino.
It's funny because, you know, this podcast, it's about scarcity and, quote, the voices in our head that... for most of us, it's not a literal, right, audio voice. And I think it's funny the way you said that, because it feels sort of like the inverse of scarcity. Like we're all familiar, but oftentimes not familiar with these underlying messages, these internal dialogue that we're hearing that many times is negative, that we're not conscious of, that's affecting the way we see ourselves or the world. But in this case... what I heard you say, and what I think is so important for anybody listening, is you heard something that was calling you in the same, kind of the opposite way of the way And you were at a place, and tell me if I'm putting words in your mouth, but you were at a place where you could hear it or you could listen to it, so to speak.
What it takes to be able to be open to the voice that's not scarcity is to be in a place of receiving and it being able to tolerate not knowing. And, you know, often in my experience, the scarcity voice comes from that protective place that I know this is safe. So when something comes from outside what that defined safe boundary is, there has to be a capacity or at least a surrender to the unknown. And so I'd practiced enough of that on a smaller level to know that I could hear the voice say, you're going to go on the Camino now, it's your time. And then naturally the other voice comes in and says, but how will I pay for it? and then it comes in and says, don't worry. All you have to do is say yes. Everything will be taken care of. And then that's all it's at.
One of the earliest podcasts that I've recorded is ironically around this idea of what does it mean to say yes to your adventure? You use that exact language and you haven't even listened to it yet. Of knowing that all of us came into this world with that sense of adventure and that somewhere along the way, we tend to settle, we tend to get caught up in the stresses of life, of surviving. You and I were talking about that earlier, just the pressure there is today for people just to survive financially. And you mentioned something at the beginning when we first were talking on this conversation. You said something to the effect of before you felt this bigger call of going on the El Camino, which for some people would be the adventure of a lifetime, you used some words about you had begun practicing that in smaller ways, like before that or something like that. And I'm just wondering if you could elaborate more or if something comes up for you when you think about like, but what does that look like to these smaller steps, these ways that we can begin to cultivate that space or that muscle, whatever we want to call it in our lives, where we say yes in even, I guess, these smaller ways.
Let's say we're in our 20s. We're very idealistic. We're very enthusiastic about getting out into the world. Most of us, I mean, I realize I'm generalizing, but we're eager to start our own lives. And we have experiences. And because of our youth, we jump into things and we don't know what we're getting into. So sometimes we hit big time and sometimes we get hurt or we fall short. And that's how we learn. So we go through a few of these experiences and each time we have a setback or a hurt or a disappointment, we're not even conscious. We just adjust and we somehow alter that initial vision, that initial ideal image to fit a reality that we are encountering. And so the possibilities get smaller and the desire to radically change shrinks. And so by the time we get into our maybe mid-30s or 40s, for some people it might even take to 50s, I know I felt this in my 30s. I just felt I was starting to die, starting to get numb. And there was a part of me that didn't want that to happen, that somehow I adjusted too much and I didn't know where I went wrong. So I started to question. And that questioning unconsciously led me to the right people, which gave me the initial experiences to open up, to experience some new energy through body work, through meditation, psychotherapy, other transformative experiences that gave me little shocks to wake me up. And I was just responding at that time to what I felt was my own inner instinct to say, I want this. I want more of this. I want my life back. Not really knowing what that was, but just.
And what I hear you saying is in a lot of like what you said, kind of smaller spaces where you, tell me if I heard you correctly, but you felt like you were numb. You felt like there was part of you that was dying, And even just kind of being with that sounds like it sounds like you were seeking out maybe then small little spaces where you would get these openings. In the meantime, you were seeking it out in this person or trying to kind of find that space in this need to survive. Is that, am I summarizing it correctly? Okay. Yeah.
Yes.
And then all those small things really led to then Esalen, and then 5 years later, the El Camino, that you didn't go from here to the El Camino overnight necessarily. And okay. Yeah.
No.
Yeah. Yeah. I try to not make this about how to's or advice for people, that kind of thing. But knowing that, I think there's a lot of people that, especially in today's world, that feel like they are just in survival mode.
Well, I mean, so yes, we have real needs that we have to meet in the world, even if we're just single and we have our job and we have to pay our rent and our bills or our college loans, or if we have a family and we have a family to support and take care of and model things. I mean, that those take a lot of energy. And those things take energy away from the time and talent and treasure that we have to put towards our own path of self-realization, personal growth, finding out who we really are, and tapping into that wellspring, that inner light of our own natural abundance and power and generativity. I think it's important to look at the small steps and the small victories, in context with our real life. Because there are some obligations we cannot just abandon completely. So I was fortunate because I'm not married. I don't own property. I wasn't in a relationship at the time, during most of this time. So it was easy for me to listen to these voices and attend to them consciously as I could. I think it requires some shadow, as the Jungians would say, to step into something we don't know, but to take the risk of abandoning a familiar life and trying on something new, or going through a transition process like a month-long Camino, to arrive only at who am I now? And now where do I go? And now what do I do? It takes a lot of freedom for that. So I acknowledged the privilege that I had in that, and just the circumstances that enabled me to do that so freely.
Yeah. Well, that's a great tie-in. You mentioned Jungian, and by Jungian, for those of you listening, we were talking about Carl Jung, and we were talking prior to recording this podcast. So one thing about Rick is you can just share where you currently work, I guess, is you work up in San Francisco.
Yeah, I'm currently the public programs manager of the C.G. Jung Institute in San Francisco.
And for those of you that don't know much, if you've heard of Carl Jung, not to put you on the spot, but you want to just do a quick little blurb on who Carl Jung was for people that have maybe never heard of him before?
Sure. So some people would only say C.G. Jung because that's how he signed his name. He never wrote Carl Gustav Jung. C.G. Jung was a psychologist who studied with Freud, became his apprentice or mentee, and then left Freud because he believed that there was something more to the psyche, to the collective unconscious, a term that Jung developed to point to our individual ability to tap into the symbols and energies, which he called archetypes, that have been accessed by everyone worldwide since antiquity in some form or another. Just sort of this big treasure chest that we all have access to, made of psychic energy that helps inform our lives, helps shape the directions that we choose, and our moment to moment feelings and awakenings. And so, So in after leaving Freud, Jung had what we might call a psychotic break and spent a number of years working on, out his process of, it was really just sort of like channeled material that just fell in his lap, and he wrote it down, he drew it out, he spent years, and it was sort of like the download for his life's work on archetypal psychology, depth psychology, his theories of complexes and the shadow, and the contents of the archetypes, his concept of synchronicity, which he didn't publish until later in his life. The seeds of that are contained in what he called the Red Book, which is now available to the public, which contains his initial process of unfolding all this rich, rich material from his unconscious.
Nice. And you said three words there that I'd love to kind of break down as well for people. The first one, you kind of already hinted at it, but archetype. If you had to try to explain to someone again what an archetype is, how would you describe that?
So archetype literally means first blow, and what that implies is we archetypes are on the divine level. We don't actually see them or know them. Similar to the concept of the Tao in Chinese philosophy, we can only see its imprints, its marks, and or its symbols. So these divine energies, these archetypes, come in many forms, and we can look at symbols of them in mythology, such as the god Zeus or Dionysus, or we can call Mother Earth an archetype even. And we're not in direct relationship, but we see its effect on our lives and in our inner life through our dreams or the chance encounters we have with people or the moments when we're overtaken by some kind of energy or force and do something extraordinary, whether that's good or bad. It doesn't really matter to the archetype. That's a little bit about how archetypes work and how we might experience them.
Nice. And tied to what you said about mythology, and Rick alluded to this earlier about, I mean, when they've studied different civilizations for centuries to see, and this is what I find just so amazing, to see that the same archetypes, no matter what part of the world, no matter what time period, to see these same symbols all being there. And so it seems like that was like a lot of what had already existed, I guess. But then what you're saying is Jung kind of took it, I don't want to say he took it a step further, but don't you feel like in some ways he was sort of an integrator in a way of beginning to kind of try to integrate some of these different, this broader knowledge perhaps of how archetypes have been found, but then talking about it in a more, he did something I feel like different, his contribution in advancing some of this work. Do you feel? I mean,
well, I've heard that Jung had written or said that he believed it was his life's mission to help people experience life symbolically, you know, to basically get more in touch with their soul. And so his purpose in developing the theory of the collective unconscious through these shared archetypes in world cultures was really in about came out of what his patients were showing him. His patients were drawing images of symbols they could not have ever seen in a book. So we're talking about the early 1900s when there was no internet. And if you had access to a library, what books could you have access to? Certainly not leather-bound, handwritten alchemical texts written in some modest monastery in the 13th century. So, or some book in China. Therefore, because people were reaching out to him, showing him stuff, because his ideas were generating some type of synergy, he began to realize that these symbols and these archetypes are in other cultures, it's not just personal. And my patients can have access to them. So is it true that everybody has access to them. And so that was his motivation for sharing so much with the world and uncovering so much with the world in symbols of alchemy, symbols of mysticism, the spiritual realm, to help people see that and hopefully find comfort in the fact that we're just connected to something more ancient than ourselves.
And you also, you use the word synchronicity, which for me in our circles, that's a very common word. I feel like it's becoming more and more common. Some people you might hear them say the word, oh, that's so serendipity, or that's kismet, or, you know, but break down for people what synchronicity is, because it's, or some people who are just pure skeptics, right, would say, well, that's just coincidence. And sometimes it might be just coincidence, but more times than not, there is something so much deeper going on that we don't always recognize. And so I don't know if you could talk a little bit more about synchronicity and how, what Jung's view was on synchronicity and how we know that today, I guess.
Sure. In a very simple way of describing synchronicity, it's a meaningful acausal connection between two things. That can mean a lot of things, or people could refer to a lot of things just using those words. Synchronicity hints at the idea that there's a clock over here moving at a certain time, and there's a clock over here moving at a certain time, and they're not connected to each other, but every now and then their hands are in the same place, and that opens a window. It unlocks some type of energy or force that if you're present to it, you can make use of it or make meaning from it, and get in touch with that larger sense of that we can't know everything, you can't explain everything in a linear causal way. So, for example, how could I ever explain that, you know, a person I met in London 1 year and left me a note inviting me to a dinner that I could never attend, so I never wrote him back, would suddenly appear at a bar in New York 2.5 years later and be staring right at me and remembering me. And I'm thinking, what? How did this happen?
With billions of people on this planet.
Billions of people, 2.5 years later, so many bars in New York City. What does that mean?
Yeah.
And I still don't really know what that means, I'll be honest. But it's a synchronicity to me. It's meaningful. That encounter is still alive in me. Mm. All these years later, actually. Yeah.
Yeah. I had my big, I mean, there's a lot of them, but my big story like that was years ago. I think I had written on a 3x5 card that I wanted to meet Steve Carell. I don't know if I've told you this story, but, and it was actually that next weekend, I was actually supposed to go up to Esalen for this men's retreat that I always did. And the road had washed out. And so, I was sitting there in the airport. I had to get a ticket last minute and sitting there in the airport, reading on my Kindle, something about the collective unconscious. And I thought, when am I going to meet Steve Carell? I'm just like totally setting myself up for disappointment. And so I close my Kindle and I get on the plane. And right when I walk into the plane, there sitting in first class is Steve Carell and his wife, you know, and I broke protocol, which you don't do in LA. And I actually, you know, just, I said, I just wrote down last weekend on a 3x5 card that I wanted to meet you. I'm not a stalker, I promise. But yeah, I mean, what are the chances of that, right? I mean, those, and I know they don't always have to be big things, they can be small things, but I think you hit on a really important point about availability and our presence and our ability to see the things sometimes that when those two hands on the clock do overlap, how many times they overlap and we're just not in a place to see it or to experience it, you know?
Yes, exactly. And we miss those meetings of the hands a lot of the times because we're just not looking. And we're not good enough at practicing how to be available to look. So that synchronicity happens, is actually happening all around us all the time. Much in the way that Jung believed that that it's only in the nighttime that we're paying attention to our dreams, but that there's actually part of us dreaming all the time, doesn't stop.
And we were talking before we started recording, you know, we were reflecting on how much Carl Jung did do. Like, he was married, he had a family, he wrote the Red Book, volumes and volumes of things, built Bollingen, which was the stone, I mean, this almost like castle. And I, when we were talking, I said, good night. Like, I mean, I just struggle to keep up with all these existing things in my life. And I thought you had a really great insight. And you said that was before, basically you said that was before TV, before the internet, before all these little kind of siphons that tend to kind of take away a lot of our time in ways that we may not even be aware. I mean, he was a genius, obviously. I mean, but pretty amazing considering he had like 5 kids, right? Or how many kids did he have? He had like, I mean, at least 5, right? Wasn't it?
I don't remember, but okay. at least three.
Okay.
Probably could be 5.
Yeah.
And it's admirable that he devoted his entire life to making time for his inner life. So Bollingen was the building of his other house on Lake Zurich, using only medieval tools and only medieval techniques to honor that ancient self from his inner life, was a continuation of the exercise he started with the Red Book.
So the Red Book, it's a huge, huge, literally Red Book that's filled with all kinds of different drawings. Most of it's written in, actually all of it's written in German. But there's a companion guide to it that I had been reading, and to basically help you understand the Red Book more. But one of the things I was so struck by was to hear even Jung's own self-doubt and hesitation to put this out into this world. And I found great comfort in that, because, I mean, this is so small potatoes, but this was right before I was trying to kind of get this, even this podcast going, or anything, quote, new in our lives where we feel like we're maybe giving expression to something that is in us. It was really comforting to read that Carl Jung, like, he was afraid people would think he was a little crazy. And yet look at the contribution and the way it ended up being, I mean, so much of what he's done, you know, so much storytelling today now. And I found that very humanizing, I guess, because I think we tend to put people up on pedestals of like, this person's the legend. And then to read a little bit more, I guess, about his humanity was kind of comforting for me, of like, wow, even he didn't realize what was coming through him in a way at the time, perhaps, you know, or he didn't have the confidence to want to put it out at least right away while he was living, because this came out after he passed away.
Yeah, they published it in 2009, 2010. So we're talking about a good 50 years wow. after Jung died. And, you know, I think Sanu Shamdasani, who wrote the introduction to the reader for the Red Book that you're referencing, mentioned numerous conversations and with people and Jung about whether to publish the Red Book or not. And I think Shamdasani tries to put Jung's hesitation in context, in that he had all of these academic papers and scientific papers to publish, and he wanted to be thought of as a scientist, as an empirical researcher in the field of psychology. And he felt that the Red Book's, if the Red Book was included, I think he says the Red Book was not a scientific work or an empirical work, and therefore he didn't want it mixed. And secondly, I believe his real fear was that if it was out there too soon, it would invalidate the efforts he did to empiricize psychology and in-depth psychology. So, it also... Shamdasani also writes that Jung did not make a determination one way or the other when he died whether the book should be published or not. So I think the family, which ultimately became the C.G. Jung Foundation, got to a place where they were all comfortable with the timing of publishing it and its value in history at this point in time. And they are now in the process of publishing Jung's other private books, collectively known as the Black Books. By the way, Jung wasn't the only person at that time to have a quote-unquote red book. There was something in the collective in that time of documenting one's inner psychic world, and Jung learned, even while he was working on his red book, that others had something similar as well. And Jung actually encouraged his patients at the time to start their own red books.
Mm.
When Jung died, he reportedly said that he had failed in his life's mission to help people connect more deeply with their soul. I don't know how, obviously I can't know how much he really meant what he said, but after all of his works, after all of his accomplishments, after all of the, you know, the institutes that began forming around the world to help people through depth psychology, there was a part of him that said, I failed. I did not do my job. I find that humbling,
to say the least, right? explain too for people, when you keep using the word depth psychology, just break down for people who may not be familiar with that term. What does depth psychology mean?
Depth psychology is basically Jung's form of Jungian psychotherapy, as opposed to Freudian psychoanalysis, and as opposed to archetypal psychology, which one of Jung's students, James Hillman, coined and basically evolved depth psychology into a specific place, archetypal psychology, and as opposed to other, you know, cognitive-based, relational, embodied psychology. There's all somatics. There's all different types of techniques that one can use, gestalt, psychotherapy, et cetera.
And as far as depth psychology goes and Jungian psychology, again, just sort of break down for people what that approach is. It has a lot to do with this idea of wholeness.
Yes. Yeah, so Jung's, all of Jung's concepts and theories and ideas stem from what he called this process of individuation, which he mirrored to the alchemical process through the symbols and collective unconscious stories that he worked with. And individuation, he believed, was the natural path during a person's life, psychically, psychologically, to achieve wholeness, to unite the hidden and the seen, the conscious, the unconscious, the gold and the shadow, or the ego and the shadow, to have them more fully integrated by the time one died. And so by meeting the inner self and engaging with one's inner life, one just suddenly just learns to not repress or deny or hide their unconscious as much, and to not demonize it or shame it, and to learn why it's there, and to, through this process of shadow work, become more familiar with it, and then it actually is able to lend positive energy in our lives. And that's individuation can be defined in so many different ways, but in short, if you're engaging with your unconscious through a process like depth psychology, you're hoping to end by an integration of what you don't consciously have access to and what you do.
Nice. Very well said. And you hit on, I think, an important point is, you know, especially in the world that we live today, where there are very, for lack of a better word, very rigid rules sometimes of things that we should and shouldn't be, that we can and can't talk about. Especially today, we have this culture of outrage, right? Where you go on Twitter for more than 5 minutes and someone is being roasted for something.
Cancel culture.
Yes, the cancel culture, exactly. And how much that is having the unintended opposite effect of everything you just described.
It's, yeah.
Instead of it creating this container of, hey, let's explore, let's be with whatever is in your life, no judgment on any of it, we've now created this petri dish where it's, you know, you just look at somebody the wrong way and you're done, you're canceled, you know?
And how does that make you feel, like, to have a different point of view that what seems to be now a rising majority of people who are just ready to write off everybody else?
Sometimes, I mean, conversations like this, it reminds me that, oh, I'm not alone. Like, okay, this is actually where the gold is. But more times than not, it does feel like that's the dominant current. And it does sometimes feel like, but it's really hard to know how to engage with it, especially like I have so much social media anxiety and just, you know, in this world today where, I mean, the news cycles, everything, it feels like it has preyed upon feeding these illusions of separation and how much different we are and all these kinds of things. This kind of not just division, like a plurality of ideas and identities and concepts and all that, but if we can make these people identify with I'm this and you're that, well, then there's no space. There's no room for any kind of conversation. And people then don't even listen. And that's really where we're at. Nobody listens, you know? And not nobody, but a lot. And so that's what I hope a lot of this podcast can be for people, where people feel that freedom to, where we can talk about anything and people feel like it's okay to just be right where they're at. And also that no matter how alone that somebody might feel, that hopefully every time they listen to this, that they might feel a little less alone, to know that there's lots and lots of people who feel the way they do and, you know, are going through experiences that they do. But you hit on this idea too of like the shadow and shadow work, and, you know, people, I think another big thing we see today is, again, in this culture of outrage and the cancel culture, is like, oh, well, I would never do that. I'm just like, you know, that all of us are basically capable of doing anything if we're really honest. You mentioned you use the word shadow and shadow work, and I think some people might think of shadows sometimes as this evil, darker thing that's lurking in us. And that's not really what Jung meant when he talked about, you know, shadow. And so I'm wondering if you could just elaborate for people how Jung viewed the shadow and what the purpose is of a shadow.
That's a great question. Jung wrote many things about the shadow and they don't all agree, but in his simplest explanation of it, he said anything that's in the unconscious. So we have an ego, which, you know, refers to our conscious self, how we identify as ourselves that we know and love and is affirmed. He also named something called the persona, which is sort of a mask that we wear in any given social situation to navigate our environment, which is not the whole ego or the whole conscious identity, just a piece of it. And then to compensate or in complement to all of that is what's in the unconscious. And so the collective unconscious rests outside of the individual psyche. And then in the shadow, to use the general term, is everything that we have not tapped, that it is waiting for us. It includes the things that we were told are bad, and so we put them away, or we deny that those are us, even though we do them in secret, or we act unconsciously, we act out in some way in relation to that thing that somebody else said was bad or wrong, or in general intimated that not acceptable, right? So especially when we're kids and we're learning to navigate our environment and our sense of safety and to get our needs met, we put things away that we explore. So those things go in our shadow. And they're always there, and they're holding energy. So again, part of Jung's theory was when a person reaches midlife, it gets too strenuous to keep carrying all these things in our unconscious, and we have to things start happening to help us unpack them. The synchronicities, the unexpected events, the crises, to get us to say, "Look at me," and then begin relating to these to the shadow pieces. To turn towards the shadow and say, "Okay, what do you need me to know? What do you want me to do right now?" And then to evaluate what's actually there, where we got it, where it came from, how the messages of negativity were attached, and then make a decision of whether it's something we want to bring into consciousness or not, or just say, "Okay, I know you're there, and I'm related to you, and we have energy here, but now it's not your time, and we can keep talking." But yeah, there's always free will involved, and especially one wants to act in a conscious way when looking at the shadow. So we're not just going to suddenly activate our criminal or activate our thief or, you know, something like that, which we have. It's in our shadow. Yeah, stuff like that.
Yeah. And yet, again, it feels like today the message sometimes that we get, and I've found this even in, quote, you and I have been in enough circles at this point. You know, you run into some circles, even in, quote, people that are into self-growth and spiritual circles, who are like, "Oh, it's just about being positive all the time. I'm only going to let, you know, such and such in," or it's, you know, squelching, like, "Well, I'm not going to let something like doubt creep up into my life, because doubt is bad and that's not me," you know. And it's like, the more energy that we then put trying to squelch something versus what you just said of allowing it and just accepting that it's there, it's like in that stepping back, then it seems like that's when we then actually become more open to allowing this deeper sense of flow and this deeper sense of synchronicity that does then start to happen, because we're not. And, you know, when you were talking about saying yes in these small ways to the adventure, I can't help but tie that together in some ways of tying it back to even our shadow work of saying yes in these small moments of, okay, this person just really said something that drove me freaking crazy, and I'm getting really triggered right now, and I'm such and such. What is that ultimately saying about me? No, I want it to be about them.
And you know, in terms of scarcity complex and the shadow, I mean, often what we put in our shadow is our gold and our power. And we're more afraid of tapping into that than to the other things. So, you know, just imagine coming face to face with a part of you that is so generative and so energetic and so loving and so ready to energize and mobilize and get things done and go past your conscious mind's ability to concept, to even conceive of how to get from A to B. Imagine saying yes to that and not knowing, but relating to this piece of the shadow, this piece of gold in common parlance, to energize the shadow to help the conscious ego, if the ego is willing to just listen long enough and stop talking to receive what that piece has to say and share.
So resistance is a real thing. You know, when we have these places in our lives where we feel this deeper call to the adventure, like what you said, and oftentimes there's, whether it's the scarcity complex, it's the ego, whatever it is that's coming up trying to protect us. as you've navigated this life at this point in your life, and you come across these smaller points, what seem like smaller points of resistance, where there's something in you that feels stuck, what's your process, or how do you navigate those moments where you feel like you don't want to move and you do just want to stay stuck right where you're at, but yet you feel something deeper coming through?
I start by writing out from that place of the resistance. I try to connect with the feeling that it's attached to, and whether that's fear or shame or something else. And on my good days, when I'm really walking my talk, I invite the personality that this emotion's coming from to step forward. And I try to be as friendly as possible, you know, be friendly, not antagonistic. And say, tell me what you need me to know. What's going on for you? And I, you know, I write all this down, like even sometimes in movie script format. Here's me, here's this figure, you know, back and forth. Sometimes the answer comes in images, so if I'll draw the image if need be. And always offer gratitude for the sharing from that piece. And then I sit with the answer. I take it into an evaluation. What here is valid? What here is important for me as I make this decision, as I cross this threshold? I don't ignore it. That doesn't mean I stay frozen, because that's not really what I want. But I honor, at least from the place of the shadow, where, who is bringing it up, where it's coming from, why it's there, and validate the exchange of receiving that peace. And often that's enough to get both sides to talk, the ego and the peace unconscious, and come up with an agreeable way to move forward. That's when I'm on my best day.
And on your worst, or on my worst, I just eat a whole pizza.
Exactly. I eat my feelings.
And I think, like, we're joking about it, but I love how you said on your best days, because none of us do this perfectly. And so it's like, you know, there are those days then where we don't deal with it or whatever. And we just want to, like, yeah, we want to comfort and all that kind of stuff, which is part of the human experience too. And there's a place for it all, but yeah.
You know, which just brings up how courageous this exploration really is. It takes courage to do the deeper listening inside, and also to listen to other people when A, you ask for help, or B, somebody's reaching out to offer support. Or when they need you to be a listener, when they need help. It takes courage to be vulnerable. So I just want to end with honoring part of ourselves that emerges when we take our first steps. Actually, every time we take our first step, that courage has to be there.
Well said, and we will end on those words. Thank you.
Thank you. It's a scarcity complex.